This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a new documentary details the racist massacre of 1898 in Wilmington, North Carolina. A BBC documentary flips the script on who was responsible for the genocides in Rwanda and the Congo. And political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal speaks to a graduating class in Vermont. But first, much of the rich elite class of Haiti flocked to the funeral of former dictator Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier, who died of a heart attack at age 63. Duvalier and his father, Papa Doc, terrorized Haiti for two generations until a popular uprising overthrew Baby Doc in 1986 and he fled to France. Duvalier returned to Haiti 3 years ago, welcomed by U.S.-backed President Michel Sweet Mickey Martelly. We spoke with Brian Concannon, Executive Director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, which has represented many victims of the country's U.S.-backed dictatorships. We asked Concannon, did Baby Doc Duvalier, a thief and mass murderer, get away scot-free?
Well, he didn't get away scot-free. I think the partial success that we had of making him face these very serious charges for the last 30 years of his life, that was achieved with some very courageous work by the victims and by some people inside the Haitian justice system. That certainly accomplished something. But obviously, it's not a complete justice. And Baby Doc has escaped complete justice, but the victims are resolved to keep fighting to make sure that the others in the system do not escape justice. Jean-Claude was head of the very brutal Duvalier system, but there are many other people who were involved in the actual torture and arrest and stealing money, as well as giving orders and supporting that brutal system. And there is a resolution on behalf of the victims to keep fighting until those people face justice.
And what was the death toll under Jean-Claude's father and under Baby Doc?
You know, the numbers vary. They're high, though. Numbers usually start at about 20,000 people killed total, and probably close to that number of people who went in and out of the political prisons. And it was the entire population that was terrorized. By bringing a few thousand people into jail or killing them, you would obviously be able to bring great terror to all of the loved ones and neighbors of the people that were brought in. And part of their system's success was the fact that they were able to scare everybody, because no one knew who the informers were. There were the Tonton Macoutes and other regime operatives who were involved in every aspect of life in Haiti.
And when Baby Doc left, he left on a U.S. plane and went to France. How much money did he bring with him?
I don't think anybody knows how much money he brought with him. Some of the investigations that took place in his wake found that he had stolen at least $500 million. They stopped counting after that. They figured $500 million was enough to prove widespread fraud. He probably had certainly tens of millions of dollars when he left. But he did spread a lot of that out. I mean, it was a vast network that he was supporting and that was supporting him. And a lot of that $500 million went to death squads and torturers and things like that.
When he came back, Baby Doc was known to hang around at fine restaurants and other places of entertainment. He must have had protectors in Haitian society.
Our belief is that he had run out of money by the time he came back, and that his ability to live a high life was, in fact, due to his protectors. I think there are a lot of people who felt that it was to their political and economic benefit to have him back. And there's been a lot written in the last few days about how the Duvalier system has, in many ways, come back with the current government. So there certainly was widespread support among Haitian elites for Baby Doc and what he represented. And, of course, widespread fear and distaste among the majority of Haitians.
How closely connected is Sweet Mickey Martelly, the present president, to the Duvalier-esque tendency?
Well, on a personal level, President Martelly invited Mr. Duvalier up onto the podium with him to share the podium at public events several times. Mr. Martelly comes from the same political movement. Many of President Martelly's ministers, including the first prime minister, were the sons of Duvalierists. Jean-Claude Duvalier's son, Nicolas, has actually been a counselor in the National Palace during the Martelly administration. So they're very close. And another aspect that's important to note is that both were very generously supported by the United States. Although the current Martelly government has been criticized for obstructing justice, the justice investigation against President Duvalier, we should also recognize the United States did not call for Duvalier to be prosecuted until Monday, 2 days after he had passed away, and France obviously sheltered him for those 25 years.
Called for him to be prosecuted after he was dead?
Yes, and even that, they kind of pulled punches. They didn't directly mention his name, but many people, everyone from the American Bar Association to Human Rights Watch to us in personal ask, had requested the United States government, which has a vast and expensive human rights apparatus within the government. We said, hey, you've got all this apparatus. Help the Haitian government, give them the information from the classified documents, provide them the technical assistance they need, and most important, take political leadership by acknowledging that Haiti has an international law obligation to pursue Mr. Duvalier, and the U.S. government refused to do any of those things.
Martelly was elected with a turnout of, I believe, less than 20% in an election in which the nation's most popular political party, the family Lavalas, was not allowed to participate. What are the prospects for new elections?
The new elections are 3 years overdue. All of the mayors and a third of the Senate, those seats have been either vacant or appointed by the president for the last 3 years. There's going to be another third of the Senate, and all of the House of Representatives is going to be vacant in January if there aren't going to be elections, and there won't be. So it looks like you're going to have the government ruling by decree starting sometime early next year. And there's great concern that the government is trying to manipulate the elections when they do happen, which will probably be a year from now, to exclude not only Family Lavalas, but many other opposing political parties. They've already started putting people in jail. There's some political activists who've been put in jail on trumped-up charges. The Martelly government has been very aggressive going after former President Aristide, head of the Family Lavalas Party, on a series of trumped-up charges that are illegally pursued.
And Aristide remains under house arrest.
Well, technically, house arrest doesn't exist in the Haitian legal system, although the judge claims to have imposed that. It's a little bit ironic that the judge even said that. This is someone who's kept an extremely low profile. I believe he's left his house 2 times in the 2.5 years since he's been back, and one of those times was to go to court. The police withdrew President Aristide's security unit, which all former presidents have been offered, and they withdrew that security unit and instead put a surveillance unit outside his house to monitor his movements, which is causing great concern to President Aristide and his supporters.
So in Haiti, you have a Duvalierist in power, and he may be ruling by decree next year. Sounds like a return of Duvalierism.
That is certainly the fear of a fairly broad spectrum of patients, both people that are politically active, but just people on the streets, journalists. A lot of people are seeing those patterns appear again, and they're deeply troubled by it.
Do you think that the Haitian people would tolerate such a regime today?
Part of the question is what the Haitian people are allowed to tolerate. Right now, Haiti is occupied by a UN peacekeeping force that has been there for 10 years. 1 in 10 UN peacekeepers are in Haiti, even though Haiti has not had a recognized war in any of our lifetimes. And so one of the purposes of that UN mission is to keep a lid on political dissent. And so that does leave the average Haitian voters limited ability to effectively express their opinions. They've been doing what they can. There were, just last week, there were several demonstrations that had thousands of people, and there is certainly a movement growing, but it's difficult to organize under the current context of repression. Many leaders of demonstrations have been put in jail, and although people in Haiti are traditionally very courageous, that kind of repression does work.
Brian Concannon of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. Much of the world has been led to believe that Paul Kagame, the current strongman in Rwanda, was responsible for halting the genocide of his fellow Tutsis in 1994. However, for the first time on mainstream media, a BBC documentary shows that it was Kagame and his rebel forces that set off the mass killings in Rwanda when they assassinated the presidents of both Rwanda and neighboring Burundi. Kagame's forces seized power and then invaded the Congo, setting off another, much larger genocide that has so far killed 6 million Congolese. International lawyer Peter Erlander has represented Rwandans opposed to the Kagame dictatorship. His work was key to showing that Kagame, far from halting the genocide, was the man most responsible for the slaughter.
Well, I think the BBC documentary is extremely important because it's the first attempt in the mainstream media to describe the evidence that was introduced at the United Nations Tribunal for Rwanda several years ago that resulted in all of the trial chambers at the UN Tribunal and the appellate chamber at the tribunal deciding that based on the evidence, the former government and military of Rwanda did not conspire and plan a genocide. The story of what happened in Rwanda has been told by the victors in a 4-year war. And of course, the victors tell the story in a way that benefits them. That's the story that people around the world have heard about Rwanda, but it's not the story that the evidence shows.
Yes, it's a story that winds up with 5 or 6 million people in the Congo losing their lives, but begins with the death of 2 presidents, and in the world today, a misconception about who probably killed them.
Well, what we have is the chief prosecutor of the UN Tribunal, Carla Del Ponte, in the documentary explaining that she had the evidence to prosecute Paul Kagame as early as 2002, and when she attempted to prosecute Kagame on that evidence, she was removed from her office by the United States and United Kingdom and told that she could not prosecute him. She was fired, essentially, for attempting to act on the evidence that showed Kagame was responsible for the assassinations. And it was those assassinations that touched off the mass violence. What was not in the documentary is that the U.S. ambassador to Rwanda in November of 1993 told Kagame that that's what was going to happen because the president of Burundi in October of 1993 had been assassinated and the same mass violence exploded there. So this was the second explosion of mass violence after the assassination of a president in these 2 countries, not the first. There had been the Burundi genocide precedent that predicted that this was exactly what was going to happen if the president of Rwanda was assassinated. This was not a surprise to anyone. The documentary also shows that a former special agent for the FBI, who was an investigator for the UN Tribunal, and a team of investigators recommended the prosecution of Kagame in 1997 to the then chief prosecutor, Louise Arbour, who then took that information and rather than prosecuting Kagame, fired the investigators. So Kagame's complicity in the investigation has been known for many years by the UN, by the U.S., and that evidence has been part of the tribunal investigative arsenal for many years that has been covered up.
When we use the word complicity, we also need to apply that to the United States. Kagame did not have the influence to cause the firing of these officials. Only a superpower could do that.
It's not a mystery. Carla Del Ponte explains meetings in the State Department in May of 2003, in which she was present with the U.S. Ambassador for War Crimes, Pierre Prosper, and the members of the Rwandan government, in which she was ordered to turn her files over to the Rwandan government. And when she refused, she was told that her job was no longer hers and she would be removed from office. And roughly 60 days later, she was removed from office.
regarding the assassination of the two presidents, the presidents of Rwanda and Burundi. Only one side had an interest in that occurring.
The assassination was actually accomplished by two surface-to-air missiles hitting the presidential plane as it came in to land. And that plane also was bringing a delegation of senior military officials back from talks in Dar es Salaam. The result of that was the entire leadership structure of the Rwandan government was decapitated. So the leadership of the government that was defending from an ongoing invasion by the RPF was eliminated. That gave the invading forces an advantage, but more than that, it also served as notice to the population that their government and their military was unable to protect the president, which meant that the population themselves could not be protected by their military or their government. And after 3.5 years of war, this was an incredibly shocking event because the president was also seen as being the father of the country. Most of the citizens in Rwanda were too young to remember anyone else who had been president. So it was an incredibly destabilizing event.
And yet the myth still is abroad in the world that Paul Kagame and his forces actually stopped a genocide that was ongoing against Tutsis.
Well, stories are stories, but there's been a lot of scientific research based on data that shows what actually did happen during the war. And what we do know is that within 2 weeks after the assassination, the RPF army was able to move from a very small sliver of Rwandan territory to controlling somewhere between one half and two thirds of the eastern part of the country in a very short period of time. General Dallaire, who was head of the UN mission to Rwanda, characterized it as a blitzkrieg operation. That sort of operation requires enormous amounts of pre-planning in terms of logistics, materiel, organization of troops. And if there was pre-planning on the part of either side, it must have been in the planning the blitzkrieg operation, because it's quite clear, and the court found, that there was no evidence of pre-planning on the part of the side that was defending the country, because they were not part of a conspiracy to assassinate their own president. Therefore, the real planning that was taking place was planning for the final assault after the assassination of Habyarimana. And it was used as part of the military tactics of the side that was winning the war.
And under this blitzkrieg, a huge refugee crisis was created, with folks, mostly Hutus, streaming out of Rwanda and into Congo, pursued by the Kagame forces.
Yeah, it was largely Hutu, but it was also Tutsi, because we have to remember that the invading RPF army were largely English-speaking, the leadership certainly, were English-speaking Tutsis from Rwanda. And the Tutsis that remained in Rwanda were French-speaking Tutsis who largely had made their peace over years with the French-speaking Hutus who were dominant in Rwanda. And it's not often easy to tell the difference between Hutus and Tutsis because of intermarriage. So many Tutsis were also fearful of the invading army. And we know, for example, that the census figures show that there were 500,000 individuals who identified themselves as Tutsis before the war began, and 300,000 who identified themselves as Tutsis in Rwanda after the war was over. So a large number of Tutsis were killed during the war, but that can't account for the numbers that the Rwandan government describes, 800,000 to a million. There must have been many Hutus that were killed in order to reach those numbers.
And then in Congo in 1994, the much larger genocide begins, the largest, in fact, in the world since World War II, and lasts until the present day.
And that, I think, is the key to this, is that once the RPF was established as one of the most, if not the most, significant military power in that region. And that occurred between January 1991 and January 1993. The RPF was originally defeated as a small part of the Ugandan army that deserted and went into Rwanda in October 1990. They were soundly defeated, withdrew in January or December of 1990-91. They came back in force in February of 1993, and during those 2 years went from 2,500 defeated Ugandan troops to an army of 25,000 well-armed, highly trained, well-organized and provisioned light infantry that were capable of taking the entire country. They proved that with an assault that was turned away only because of French and Belgian assistance to an overmatched Rwandan army. That military power was used in 1994 after the assassination of the president, 18 months later, to seize power in Rwanda, and then that military power, together with the Ugandan military power, was used to invade the Congo in 96, and again several years later, and to occupy the eastern Congo ever since. And the estimates of the deaths that have resulted is 5 million to 10 million, and the killing goes on today.
And that ongoing slaughter in Congo could also not have happened without U.S. and British complicity.
Well, that's certainly right, because the militaries, of course, have become in some ways self-sustaining entities now because of the resource rape of the eastern Congo, but also because the RPF military is used as peacekeepers by the United Nations, and it's RPF and Ugandan troops that are the peacekeepers in Darfur, that are the African Union troops in Somalia. And in fact, Ugandan troops were actually used in Iraq when U.S. troops were spending their first tour of duty there. It seems as though this has been a very cooperative arrangement between the U.S. and Kagame.
The United States is now posing as a kind of honest broker in the region, as if it has not been acting hand in glove with Kagame all these years.
Well, I think the best place to examine that issue is probably at the UN tribunal itself, because it clarifies the relationship in a very narrow and discreet way. Carlo Del Ponte, the chief prosecutor, not only spoke for the BBC documentary, but she also wrote a book in which she explained the role of the U.S. at the tribunal. And her description of how the U.S. and U.K. ran interference for Mr. Kagame, and the descriptions of the investigators for the ICTR who were fired because of their diligence shows quite clearly that the $2 billion that the UN spent on this tribunal that was supposed to prosecute all crimes that occurred in Rwanda during 1994 was used intentionally to tell the side of the story that benefited the victors in the war, and to ignore and really cover up the crimes committed by the victors, and in the last analysis, events like the assassination of the two presidents that actually caused the genocide were never prosecuted.
Most Americans will probably never see the BBC documentary. It's been very difficult getting any traction to challenges to the myth of what happened in Rwanda here in the United States.
That certainly is true. And because this doesn't affect the people of the United States in their daily lives, that's likely to continue. We have to remember that the myth of the weapons of mass destruction was a myth that lasted for quite a long time as well. And even today, I think there have been polls that show that many people, if not most of the people in the United States, think that Saddam Hussein was somehow connected with Osama bin Laden. Of course, both of those are myths and canards that were used by our government to try and get support for policies that really not in the best interest of the people of the U.S. and certainly were not truthful reasons for foreign policy. This is going to be a story that probably is not determined by the U.S. people, but by the people of Africa who are having to live this. But the more that it can be understood that the U.S. and the world have been sold a myth, the more likely it is that the people who have to live with the consequences are going to be able to change their situation. This sort of mythology of history, it can't be allowed to determine how it is that the people of Africa are going to organize their future.
And in the early years of the fighting in Rwanda, Paul Kagame was actually in training at a U.S. Army college in Kansas.
As an officer in the Ugandan Army, he was part of a Pentagon training program that brought upper mid-level African officers to Fort Leavenworth for training and for developing ties with up-and-coming officers in the U.S. military. And he went from that training program directly to leading the RPF in November of 1990, when the invasion from Uganda happened. But I hasten to add here that it isn't just Kagame who benefited from that training. My client, who was a major in the Rwandan Army, also trained at Fort Leavenworth. And the Pentagon program doesn't differentiate between friends and enemies. Surprisingly enough, the idea is to develop ties and influence with military officers throughout the continent so that whichever side wins, the Pentagon has someone that they can talk to. In this case, the support went to the RPF. And so Kagame was the one the Pentagon was talking to. But the Pentagon has the ability to talk to both sides in most conflicts. So I don't want to have that taken as a necessary connection. Because what the idea is to infuse U.S. doctrine and military principles into the African military in a general sense.
Perhaps your most celebrated client was Ms. Inga Berry. You referred to her situation earlier. She
right.
was sentenced to a long time in jail. Do things like the BBC documentary possibly alter her prospects for serving out that time?
Well, I think that to the extent that the Kagame regime's legitimacy come into question, the possibility of the sentence of Ms. Inga Berry being reduced or the possibility of her being released increase, because it's quite clear that Ms. Inga Berry was not consorting with rebels, and her intention and her actions were those of a political candidate, and it was those actions that caused her to be arrested, just as what caused me to be arrested was having done nothing other than consult with her and having written and talked about issues outside of Rwanda that the Rwandan government disapproved of, because I wasn't prosecuted for anything that I did in Rwanda. I made no public statements. I simply consulted with her. The legitimacy of the Rwandan government, however, is undermined in the long run by taking those actions.
Is it inaccurate to characterize Paul Kagame's regime as a minority dictatorship?
Well, I think it's a minority within a minority because, as I mentioned, the French-speaking Tutsis who were indigenous to Rwanda and the English-speaking Tutsis are at odds as well in many instances because the French-speaking Tutsis are sometimes seen as traitors by the English-speaking Tutsis, and so a minority within a minority, I think, is actually more accurate.
That was international lawyer Peter Erlander. Over the ferocious objections of national police organizations, political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal addressed graduating students at Vermont's Goddard College, where he received his bachelor's degree back in 1996, while still on death row. Abu-Jamal is now housed in the general population at Frackville State Prison in Pennsylvania. He had this message for his fellow graduates.
Dear fellow Goddardites, students, graduates, parents, professors, I thank you for your kind invitation to join you in voice today. I've been away from Goddard College perhaps longer than most of you have been alive. I last walked on campus during the late 70s. But although it was undoubtedly quite a long time ago, it still sits in memory, and sometimes even visits in dreams of the funky atmosphere that suffused the campus like a cloud of exhaled marijuana smoke. What really moved me, however, was the green life, the abundance of grass, trees, standing like ancient sentinels, the majestic mountains of Vermont, which possessed a beauty that was, to a guy from the city, simply breathtaking. I remember, with crystal clarity, walking through the woods back to our dorms, Third World Studies, and feeling pure rapture in the presence of those trees. How many centuries had those trees stood on this earth? My mind looked back to Indians who must have trod through these very same woods, my steps touching the ground that once crunched under their moccasined feet. Not only have the surviving remnant of their once great numbers been banished from the land of their fathers, but the reverence with which they held these lands, their collective embrace of Mother Earth, has been banished as well. That living immensity, more sacred than anything built by man, has never left me and rises up like a phoenix whenever I think of the campus. But of course, what really matters here is not my experience, but yours. This is your commencement. As such, I will dwell on the world that you are about to enter into, inhabit, and true to Goddard's founding ideals, hopefully transform. As we all know, Goddard is rightly famous for its non-traditional teaching methods and focus. Here, students stand at the center of the educational endeavor, and they are urged and expected to follow that vibe in their hearts, that which gives them passion to determine not just what they will study, but how those studies can have impact and meaning in the larger society. You know, this ain't a cookie-cutter school. Goddard, deeply influenced by the ideas of John Dewey, 1859-1952, strives to reach that happy and singular medium between the teacher and the taught, with one exploring with the other how best to achieve a meaningful resolution to questions that arise in the life of the mind. Quoting Dewey, education is not preparation for life. It is life itself. Dear graduates, never have words such as these been truer to the hour that is upon us. For the nation is in deep trouble, largely because old thinking, both domestically and globally, has led us into the morass that the nation now faces, which may be encapsulated by references to place names that ring in our minds: Gaza, Ferguson, and Iraq again. These are some of the challenges that abide in the world, which it will be your destiny to try to analyze and resolve. As students of Goddard, you know that these challenges are not easy, but they must be faced and addressed. The Brazilian scholar Paulo Freire, in his groundbreaking Pedagogy of the Oppressed, posits the power of literacy to transform psychology, to deepen and broaden one's place in the world. Moreover, when one seeks to interrogate one's radical beliefs, it draws one deeper into contact with the meaning of social change and social transformation. One is changed, the prerequisite to social change. Goddard, because of its size and orientation, has given students the time and attention to find the focus to answer questions that few other places have even dared to entertain. In many ways, it is issues such as these that makes Goddard Goddard. Questions of power, of politics, of race, of gender, of place. Questions about where one stands in the world and how to move, act, interact in a world awash in complexity. Essentially, how does a young person, or for that matter, even an older one, looking at the vast, wide world with a quiet sense of terror, have a voice amidst that monstrous din? How does she find that voice that can create space to think, to be, to grow. We know that it must come from the place within, that which moves you, that which stirs you, that which is your truest, deepest self. Goddard, unlike most such institutions of higher learning, quietly asks that you listen to and interrogate that voice, and when appropriate, amplify it. For who knows, within that deepest you may dwell the very voice that is resonating within the nation, if not the world itself. Here, social change and social transformation forms the raison d'etre of Goddard. We need new questions for the world of the 21st century, but more importantly, we need new answers. We live in a world where massive wars can be launched by rumors and innuendo, where the material interests of corporations are superior to the interests of working people. And remember, corporations are people, so saith the Supreme Court, where the ecological threats to fresh water supplies, clean air, and the environment in American cities pose challenges that seemed beyond our ken. Did I not say that we need new thinking? The present social, political, ecological, and global course is, to say the least, unsustainable. Perhaps some of you, new graduates of Goddard, will think up ways to forestall some of the challenges facing the living and generations unborn. I noted earlier my reverie in the woods of Goddard, that exquisite freshness in the wintry air, the nighttime respiration of hundreds of magnificent evergreen trees, has refreshed my mind even when miles and decades away from Goddard's sweet, cool earth. Our cities, built during the heights of the industrial age and now engulfed in post-industrial ennui, badly need a greening. Areas should be set aside where children and mothers can breathe and remember air loaded with freshness delivered by green life, not air-conditioned. Think of the myriad of problems that beset this land and strive to make it better. That's Dewey's vision and Goddard's. Let me say something that I've never said before. When I came to Goddard, I was intimidated. Although teachers and adults told me that I could do the work, I rarely believed them. I felt woefully unprepared. But guess what? Goddard gave me confidence, and I never lost that feeling. When I returned to Goddard, many years later, I was a man on death row with a date to die. I was able to transfer credits from continuing education, and my final paper utilized the writings of Frantz Fanon and Ignacio Martín Baró to examine the concepts of both in liberation psychology and liberation theology. Only at Goddard. Only at Goddard. Goddard reawakened in me my love of learning. In my mind, I left death row to travel to France, where Fanon studied psychiatry, and on to Blida Hospital, north of Algiers, where he practiced and later joined the Algerian Revolution. By studying Martín Baró, I traveled to El Salvador, where he worked as a priest and psychologist, teaching literacy to peasants. When the nation groaned under military terror, supported by El Norte, the U.S. Empire. Who were these figures? Well, Fanon was born in the Caribbean island of Martinique, then a colony of France. When he witnessed the oppression of the Arabs in Algeria, he felt compelled to join the revolution on the side of what he called the wretched of the earth. Ignacio Martín Baró was among six Jesuit priests, a housekeeper and her daughter, slain by the U.S.-trained Atlacatlo Battalion, a notorious Salvadoran death squad. Goddard supported those trips abroad, if only in the mind, and I thank the school and many of my friends and alums there immensely for opening a door closed for decades. Goddard allowed me to really study what interested and moved me, revolutionary movements, and through that doorway, history, psychology, politics, and of course, economics. In one of the most repressive environments on earth, death row, Goddard allowed me to study and research human liberation and anti-colonial struggles on two continents, Africa and Latin Central America. I thank you for that grand opportunity. For you graduates, your studies, visits to lands beyond your own, were done to give you both insights and confidence to work in the world, to try to create social change. Your job isn't how to get a job. It's to make a difference. I thank my friends at Goddard for inviting me back. If it's done for you half of what it's done for me, I assure you, you will have been well served. Now take what you know and apply it in the real world. Help be the change you're seeking to make. I thank you all. For the class of 1996, Goddard, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
The Pennsylvania State Legislature is considering a bill that would allow the silencing of people like Mumia Abu-Jamal on the grounds that their speech causes mental anguish to victims' families. In 1898, the post-Civil War Reconstruction finally came to an end with the massacre of blacks and some of their white Populist Party allies in Wilmington, North Carolina. Christopher Everett is on his way to completing a documentary on the Wilmington Massacre, titled Wilmington on Fire. Everett talked to us about the historical background of the event.
It was a statewide white supremacy movement. It was really to take control over the whole state of North Carolina. And the reason why they targeted to do the massacre in Wilmington, it was because Wilmington was the largest city in North Carolina back in the 1890s. And it was also a majority black population as well. So the reason why they did this massacre, it was really to put out a signal to the rest of North Carolina that, okay, if we can take over Wilmington, that means the whole state will eventually follow. So, and that's what they did.
In fact, the fall of Wilmington really marks the end of radical Reconstruction and the end of an alliance between white populists and black Republicans in the South and in North Carolina.
Yes. You had back then, you had this thing called the Fusion Movement, and that was the whole thing with the Populist Party and the Republican Party. And, you know, back then, majority of black people were Republicans. It was totally different than what the Republican Party is today. But back then, you had the Fusionist Movement, and black Republicans and populists kind of merged together to really put their people in public office. And in Wilmington, per se, you had black people who were on the police department, were on the fire department. You had black people on the board of aldermen. You had a black man. He was like the chief customs clerk for Wilmington. You had black people in the post office, the postal service back then. Black people were owning businesses throughout Wilmington. So it was a real, real progressive city. It was really what the whole Reconstruction era was supposed to been, you know, in the South after slavery. But that all changed with the whole 1898 massacre.
And how did this massacre begin? What set off the white supremacist attack and overthrow of the Republican fusion black-white government there?
The Democratic Party, they developed different branches of the Democratic Party, and we talk about this in the film. One branch was called the White Government Union, and we actually got their documentation. We have their constitution and bylaws and everything. And in their constitution and bylaws, it says that there has been a division amongst the white man, and the division was the whole fusionist movement. When it says it in their constitution and bylaws, we have to break up this fusion movement of the populists and Republicans to bring back those white men back into our party to uphold white supremacy. And that was the whole reason why the Democratic Party created the White Government Union and these other branches of the Democratic Party. Then you also had other groups that did the dirty work, like the Red Shirts. And the Red Shirts were similar to the Ku Klux Klan, but the thing with them, they did all their dirty work in broad daylight, and they didn't have any mask on. But they did the exact same thing that the KKK would do back then as well. They were very organized. They were very organized. They pretty much started plotting and planning, I would say, in the early 1890s, which led all the way up to 1898 with the Wilmington Massacre.
And the white supremacists did have a pretext, and it involved an editorial in a black newspaper.
This editorial was by Alex Manley. If anyone would look at his picture, a lot of people would think he was a white guy, but he was of mixed race, but he lived as a black man. We actually have his grandson in the film as well. But Alex Manley, there's always been speculation, did he actually write the editorial? But anyway, the editorial showed up in his newspaper, and it was pretty much a response from Rebecca Felton, She was a racist white supremacist down in Georgia. And I think she was like the first female U.S. senator. And she pretty much made a statement saying that, you know, white women need to be protected by their white men. Black men are just ravagely doing what they want to with white women on the farms. And white men just need to uphold white womanhood. So Manley, I think about a year later, you know, pretty much read the article. And he just had a response to it saying that white women are pretty much not even raped by black men. A lot of time they're actually having sexual relationships with black men, and especially mulatto men like himself. So this is the tool that the white supremacists use. They were going to do the massacre anyway, but this kind of speeded up the process by using this article, and then they just plastered it all over North Carolina. And that's another tool that they used too, was propaganda. Because when you look at it, a lot of the people behind the 1898 massacre owned newspapers throughout the state. And one of the biggest ones was the Raleigh News and Observer, which is still in existence today, and the Wilmington Star News that is still here today. And a lot of them just used this propaganda to add fuel to the fire and pretty much led up to the whole massacre and the destruction of the black community in Wilmington, North Carolina.
So how did the actual armed takeover begin?
Well, the first act, you had the elections in November 8th. The Democrats won by pretty much voter intimidation. Then November 10th comes, and they tell the Colored Citizens Committee to tell Alex Manley, the black-owned newspaper, to stop his newspaper press and get out of town. So they write a letter to the Colored Citizens Committee, your influential black leaders in the city during that time. They write a letter back to Alfred Waddell. He was pretty much one of the main guys who led the massacre, the actual killing of everybody. They sent a letter to him saying that we'll tell Alex Manley to leave town, just anything to keep peace. Waddell said he didn't get the letter, but down the road you found out he actually did. He just didn't care. So he doesn't let everyone know that they're going to tell Alex Manley to leave. So they just go to the armory, which was the Wilmington Light Infantry building. They had a big rally. There was about 500 people out there rallied up. They got the guns. They went to Alex Manley's newspaper building. He was already warned ahead of time to get out of town, so Manley wasn't there. They burned the newspaper building down, marched to the other area called Brooklyn, which that was the name of the black neighborhood in Wilmington during that time, and they went all over Brooklyn, just an all-out slaughter of killing black people. And it lasted for weeks, and a lot of the women and children ran to the cemetery to hide until everything had calmed down. But they just killed people, man, and it just totally, totally devastated the city. Half of the black population was cut in half, I say within a year's time, because a lot of people were killed. A lot of people just left the city and just never came back. And Wilmington has never had a full-fledged black population ever since.
Among those who left was George White, the last of the black Reconstruction congressmen.
Yeah, George White, he wasn't in Wilmington per se, but he was a congressman for North Carolina. And we talk about this in my film. Another reason why these white supremacists did the massacre, it was really to set forth for the 1900 election campaign so they could take full control of the legislative branch so then they can get the governorship. And then when that happened, George Henry White was pretty much out because, you know, no one was going to vote for him no more because it was just all Democrat. So he decided just to leave as well. And he decided that, you know, we're not going to do anything here in North Carolina anymore because of racism. So he moved up north and started a town called Whitesboro in New Jersey. And we kind of talk about this and show this in the film. But Whitesboro was started by him, and people like Booker T. Washington gave him the funds to start the town as well. But Whitesboro was actually a refuge for people in Wilmington and also throughout North Carolina. It's just a new start of getting away from white supremacy and just starting over. When you look at the directory for Whitesboro, you see some of the same names from the early Wilmington City directories as well. And you can just see how they just left and just moved up there just to start another life.
And what's the estimated death toll for the Wilmington massacre?
See, there are a lot of different stories. And this is what the white supremacists did when they owned the newspapers. They just put out fake stories saying that we had to just rise up and it was only a few casualties. You'll see things like it was just four people killed. It was six people killed. And this is the lie they told for over 100 years. But then when you look at it, some estimates say it was 100, some say it was 500. I think it was probably in the thousands, because just the population that just decreased over half of a year time period says a lot. But no one really knows per se, but all you can kind of do is just go off of stories and things like that. But I would say it was in the thousands.
Many people, most people, don't even know about the Wilmington Massacre. Many have seen the Muhammad Ali TV movie film based upon Howard Fast's novel, Freedom Road. It's based on an amalgam of real events, but essentially a novel. But here we have a story about Black Reconstruction and its crushing by armed force, and it involves both Black and white people on the same side, and yet it's an unknown story, largely.
Well, it's been unknown because they really were organized on how they wanted to do this. But the thing is that the whole world kind of knew about this. I know the guy we got in the film, Alex Manley, his grandmother, she wasn't in the country during the time. She was part of the Fisk Singers. I think they were in Europe when the massacre happened. But she was all the way in Europe, and she heard about it. And then you got letters that people sent to President McKinley during the time. All over the country, from Colorado, California, New York. So the whole country was hearing about this, but the white supremacists, the leaders behind the massacre, after it happened, they put out a story that it was corruption in government and we just had to rise up and rebel. And that's the narrative that they put out. So a lot of people just kind of say, yeah, well, you know, I guess that's what really happened. But what really, really made people look at the 1898 massacre was the next event that happened in Wilmington, which was the Wilmington 10 incident in 1971. And that would really, really put the spotlight on Wilmington. And then when people saw what happened with the Wilmington 10, people started browsing around in the history of Wilmington. And then when you look at the Wilmington 10, you see that the city of Wilmington is just synonymous with racial violence that went back to the 1898 massacre.
How does one pay for a film project such as this? Certainly you're not going to get any backing from the major studios.
Oh, no. I kind of got the idea of doing the project a few years ago. I was doing a small documentary film for a historical school in my hometown of Laurinburg, North Carolina, called the Laurinburg Institute. And I was doing a small fundraising documentary film for them. And that's how I kind of got interested in the history of North Carolina in regards to the whole white supremacy movement. Because when I was talking to the guy who still runs the school today, his grandparents started the Laurinburg Institute in 1904. And he was saying that how a lot of people didn't want to come to Laurinburg during this time because of the racism. And I was like, okay, well, let's see what was going on back then. And then when I would research the stuff, you know, 1898 would always pop up. And so I just started just looking more and more into it. I was like, okay, I want to do this as my next project. But I didn't really have any money. So, and also I was unemployed at the time. I pretty much started doing the film just off of my unemployment money. And once we started getting it going and people started following it and just started liking what we were doing. Then we did a couple of fundraisers, got a few backers, and we just kept going and going and going with it. And so we're about 90% complete, and it's looking real good, and we should have it done by December.
And how can people help you out, move that completion date forward?
Well, just go to facebook.com/Wilmington on Fire. We have the donation link up there. They can check out, you know, the trailers, the clips, you know, the artwork behind the scenes, photos, and we'll put up different historical facts and different snippets and everything. But go to facebook.com/Wilmington on Fire, and you can become a backer there and contribute.
And who's featured in this film?
Well, I have three direct descendants of some of the victims of the massacre. Alex Manley, we have his grandson, Dr. Lewin Manley. We also have the great-granddaughter of Thomas C. Miller, Fay Chaplin. Thomas C. Miller was one of the most wealthiest Black men in Wilmington during this time. He was a real estate developer. He had the only pawn shop in town. He was a major businessman during this time, and he was run out of town during the massacre. He was one of the ones that were banished and lost everything. We also have descendant of Isham Quick. And Isham Quick, he was a board member of one of the Black-owned financial institutions in Wilmington during his time, and he was also exiled from the city. We have his great-great-granddaughter, Inez Eason, in the film. We also have a few activists, scholars, community activists as well, We also feature Dr. Umar Johnson from, you know, the Hidden Color series. We also have Dr. Claude Anderson in the film as well, and people are familiar with him. It's a very, very great cast. We have about 18 people. We also have Queen Kwet. She's the chiefess of the Gullah Geechee Nation. We talk about that hidden history in Wilmington as well. And she's very familiar with the whole massacre and its connection with the Gullah Geechee history, too. So we have a nice, diverse cast to go along with this thing, and everyone did very well.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. And while you're there, make plans to attend Black Agenda Report's 8th year anniversary celebration at historic Riverside Church in New York City. That's on October 24th. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.